military institutions, a free and informed media that could report and observe companies and their behavior and directors and perhaps test and validate some of the disclosures and reporting. It also involved a very active environment of various forms of activists interested in particular areas and interests, whether it's on accounting disclosure issues, environmental issues, and so forth, and also an environment which constitutes some very active, engaged institutional shareholders. And that is really one of the challenges that I observe when I look around many of the markets I'm involved in, is that those constituent elements, at least in my view, have to be all working in sync. They have to be working in some degree of symmetry, and that it's not lopsided one way or the other. And so one of the typical challenges we find in many of the markets is that at least the domestic institutional investors are passive, almost non-existent, and very often very reluctant to engage. And there's a whole host of reasons around that. So quite a lot of it to do with their affiliation within a bank or financial holding group and some of the apparent conflicts that exist there. So you move then from the so-called Anglo-Saxon approach, which is sort of more typical of a common law system, and then you start working in a civil code, a country that is more familiar with the civil law basis of a legal regime. And then everyone gets terribly confused between a civil code, which effectively is the corporate law of the country, and then someone comes along and introduces to them the need for a corporate governance code. And that creates some disparity in terms of understanding of the market. Then you move to the next step, which is really, perhaps one could say, on the other end of the spectrum, the US rules-based approach, very much personified by the Sarbanes-Oxley provisions, which has been coming for all forms of comment and scrutiny. And more recently, of course, now, as was discussed by Professor Coffey, was the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act. The problem that one encounters when one looks at the whole regulation of the market is this issue of, we had, notwithstanding the very draconian, some might say, provisions of Sarbanes-Oxley, and there's a lot of issues you can debate here. As I said earlier, I'm really talking in general terms, time not allowing this to discuss the specifics, that you still had within the US banking system a crisis that was resulted in a significant consequence for many markets around the world. Then, of course, you look at the other spectrum, which was Hector Sance, the former chief executive of the Financial Services Authority in the UK, reflecting on some of the deliberations that the regulatory environment has been looking at and making a comment reportedly that you cannot prescribe a principles-based approach to individuals who do not have principles. So now we're left with a bit of a dilemma, effectively. Do we follow a voluntary or principle-based system? Or do you follow a rules-based system? Or is it something in between? And I think the one challenge that I see on the principles-based approach is that really the regulator's job, it takes you to a point of requiring the disclosure and the necessary transparency that's called for in whatever form of corporate governance regulation or code that defines the reporting requirements that companies, whether it be listed companies or state-owned companies or an amazing host of forms of enterprise, have to make. And then the challenge for the regulator is how to, in fact, regulate and ensure that that disclosure has some form of efficacy. It is valid, it's apparent, and it can be relied upon. And the problem is, in many of the markets, at least which we operate in, one of the challenges for the regulators, unlike in the UK, where a lot of this originates from, they don't have all these natural intersecting interests in the market that are all validating and testing it, whether it's an institutional investor, whether it's a business journalist, whether it's an activist group, they're all testing and validating the disclosures that companies are making. And I think that probably, for me, is where a lot of the challenge comes with regulators, because then the issue is, how do we get the companies to do this? What is it that we need to effectively and require that they should do this? And that then brings you to the discussion that you then get confronted with, which is then, okay, well, the other alternative is a rules-based approach. And that probably is where we need to step back a little bit when we look at corporate governance, because at least in my personal view, corporate governance originally, conceptually and in practical terms, at least as I said from my personal perspective, was really to provide some practical guidance to boards and directors and companies about how to discharge their legal obligations in an effective way which would satisfy the market and the regulators in terms of the necessary standards of behavior and reporting that a company should provide to the market as given and signed off by its board of directors. In other words, companies are meant to have a chairman of the board. The corporate governance code elaborates and expands on what that should comprise, what sort of individual is best qualified, should it be a combination of the chief executive and the chairman, or should it be some separated, and all the various debates that go around that. The problem with with some of the markets, clearly the issue when they start enforcing what is really a set of practical guidance into something that is much more quasi-law, they run into the problems of that you can't, one size does not fit all. The sort of requirements that a well-run business in the chemicals industry in terms of its governance standards is going to be quite different to what perhaps a bank might want to look at in terms of its priorities and governance structures that it wants to put in place. And I think, and then that really leads to the one thing that becomes very apparent in many of the markets. And as I said, I'm leaving my comments brief deliberately with a view that it might generate some discussion on points of clarification. And I know this will probably touch a few points as far as some of you are concerned. But then I run into, or I've observed, is the issue of skills and capacity. The challenge, one is capacity, is that as regulators try and introduce this plethora of different governance systems and requirements, very often influenced particularly by developments in North America and Europe, which very often forms the basis of the international benchmarks that we find it articulated in such standards as the OECD corporate governance principles, and the difficulty of then trying to retrofit that into their market. And that is probably, I wanted to pick up a comment made earlier, is that one of the things that regulators have to look at is you need to really develop a code that's fit for purpose. It doesn't have to be best in class. It doesn't have to match your next door neighbor because they've looked to have perhaps a more sophisticated and better code than yourself. I think the issue is what can you regulate? What do you have the skills and capacity to regulate? And ensure that you regulate that well and in an effective way, because that's the message companies need, is to understand that there's a fair balance of regulation in whatever form, excuse me, that you want to regulate, and not to create something that almost from the start is impossible for companies to follow because those conditions don't exist in the market. And the two examples I give very briefly is in the one Asian country I was in recently. They got some advice, picking up on Professor Coffey's point, from a consultant. They came out with which was arguably a very good, very competent corporate governance code. When I met the inspectorate of the Securities Commission, very young, very bright people, but did not really have a clear grasp or understanding of what this code was requiring on them as a regulator or regulatory agency to enforce. In other words, a necessary understanding and judgment of the different aspects of a code that wasn't really suitable for that market. They could have had something much more simpler, and that is possibly the one point I say to regulators. It's about making, this is a process. You've got to work at it incrementally and not try and sort of come with a big bang approach, because that tends to sometimes also discredit the regulatory capacity by almost by default companies simply do not comply with those requirements. I think the issue, therefore, is what to do with all of this. And I think, you know, just so we can open this for discussion in the interests of time, one of the things that I think has become a real challenge is how corporate governance has become very politicized. And no doubt, following the global financial crisis, the politicians got really interested in governance. The regulators got a lot of pressure to do something and to be seen to be doing something. And I think the result of that in this new world order, in some ways, is we're seeing a lot of regulation, and the comments and observations have been made that I'm not sure is really fit for purpose, and we may see the consequences of that somewhere down the line. So what am I trying to say in summary? From the observations, at least in the environment that I find myself in, and particularly with a focus on developing countries and emerging markets, are really five key points, which tend to pivot around one. Very often corporate governance codes have an unnecessary sophistication for the market in which, say, someone is seeking to apply it. They've simply copied or imitated what looks like a reasonable code from another market, which without really thinking about how it will apply in their market, how it really relates to their market, and how they, in fact, going to enforce it. The second mistake very often is very often because of the difficulty of passing legislation, I've seen some countries actually try and effectively use a corporate governance code to substitute for shortcomings in matters which really are a matter of law. The third one, as I've already dealt with, is the issue of skills and capacity of regulators. Having the skills and certainly the capacity to in fact enforce these codes, and the extent to which you understand the various nuances that are involved between a principles-based approach and the more rules-based approach. Because either way, there has to be an exercise of judgment, and the question is how much intrusion you want to have in the reporting, in some cases voluntary reporting by companies, in terms of judging the effectiveness of their disclosure in the absence of these other constituent elements that I referred to just now. The fourth one is a lack of institutional capacity to support the process in terms of, for example, issues around director training and the requirement of making boards and companies aware and familiar with what the codes and standards are calling for. And probably the fifth one, which is a very tricky one, is a lack of cohesion between other regulators in the market. You'll find the banking regulator has taken a particular course of action, the stock exchange regulator has done something else, and is in the one country, as in recently, the third regulator, being the securities commissioner, has yet followed a third course of action. And imagine the companies trying to operate within that environment, so in the end they don't do anything, and then everyone gets incredibly frustrated. And that's not to mention, of course, within the 21st century, is the increasing complexity of issues around corporate responsibility reporting. The sort of things that one perhaps looks at in terms of broad guidance that one sometimes likes to discuss with a regulator is to really trying to obtain a clear definition of what you're trying to resolve. What is the mischief you're trying to prevent, and do you have the capacity, the necessary capacity, to in fact enforce and supervise the necessary or requisite behavior that you're seeking to remedy. The second one, of course, is the cost of regulation. I think this whole issue around trying to analyze the cost of enforcement and whether it really adds to the economic benefit of the country, that itself is an extremely, at least in my opinion, complex and sometimes complicated discussion. The third one is a necessity to have some measure of private-public sector dialogue. If I can refer, if I may, to the King report here in South Africa, that typically demonstrates a very strong resonance of private and public sector engagement to find common consensus and cause and purpose around what it is that you want to see improved and better, done better in the country. And then also the whole awareness raising process. And to me, the underlying principle very often is less is more. Because the sort of issues that one looks at is board training. And for example, in India, we've been working with the regulators on the issue of trying to provide training programs that enhance the quality and leadership of people who are either to serve as directors or existing directors on their listed and other regulated companies. The other one is the training of the financial media. That we've worked in some countries with the securities regulator in trying to really ensure that the media is well informed and equipped to actually report responsibly and properly on issues and not leave the regulator with yet another problem, bad reporting and trying to understand how companies are in fact adopting their laws and rules. Mervyn mentioned the issue of dispute resolution. We're finding a lot of appetite for that creeping into the regulatory environment. And then the use of instruments for supervision rather than trying to necessarily enforce standards that are difficult to enforce and supervise is the use of scorecards to monitor companies and publicize the results of those scorecards to make the public and companies aware of where their scoring is not necessarily reflecting the type of standards that the regulator would like to see, and the use of indices and things like that that we've seen in some other markets. But I think what I was really trying to raise in this very short intervention was that very often the issue around corporate governance and regulation is not so much in the design of the regulation or the corporate governance code standards and rules, but very much the issue and the challenges of the actual capacity to enforce and supervise that in a way that ensures that the market remains economically vibrant and active, and at the same time gets companies to feel that there really is an incentive and a direction in terms of its practical application of the sort of standards we'd like to see companies follow. Thank you very much.
I liked many of the points that Dr. Armstrong raised, but I thought the quote from the former head of the Financial Services Authority that, you know, how can you enforce, how can you have a principle-based code when you're dealing with people without principles is an interesting quote. I'm going to limit the surveys given that we're at 12:35. We started about 15 minutes late, so we actually have another 10 minutes. But the panelists have given us a lot of food for thought. And so what I'd like to do is open it up for discussion from you. Please stand up so that it's easier if you want to ask a question or make a comment, so that it's easier for those who have the microphones. Because it's hard, I can't see you, so whoever has the microphone needs to get it to you. And I suggest that you stand up. It's much easier to be seen if you're standing, and then grab a microphone. And what we'll do is take all the comments and questions, and then I'll have the panelists respond to them together, and then we'll close the session. There's somebody right here. Sorry, has somebody taken the...
I've got the microphone,
Thank
Chairman.
You. Please introduce yourself. Yeah.
Good afternoon. Yes. Good afternoon. My name is Jeff Van Rooyen. I have a question for Philip.
Sorry, which organization?
My name is Jeff Van Rooyen, and I'm in the private sector.
Okay.
A question for you, Philip. You've done extensive work in very many countries on corporate governance. Are there, you know, two or three best practices that have emerged from the work that you've done? If you could just share that with us, please.
Okay. The next person.
Do you hear me? Thank you. My name is Sylvester Akele. I work for the Securities and Exchange Commission, Nigeria. Quite often you hear non-executive directors claiming limitations to their liabilities. I'd like to get the views of Professor Coffey and George King on whether in this new order, non-executive directors and executive directors should be equally liable for the activities of the company. Thank you.
Okay. The next person, please.
It's okay? Okay.
My name is...
I am from Chile, Fernando Coloma. My question is for Professor Coffey, and is related with the main idea of that giving more power to the shareholders, maybe make the things worse in the sense of systemic risk. Really, I understand what he says about if the shareholders are more able to accept, that they are more able to accept more risk because they have a better portfolio diversification, and at the extreme or at the limit, they can act or they can work as a risk neutral in their decisions. But I think that in this case, you have another complexities, another things that make not so easy the relation, because under the framework of the principal agent relation, you have that, for example, the managers are more short-run oriented. The managers also under a situation in which there is no a control shareholder, they can endogenous affect the size of the bonds, the success bond and all the stuff. So the payoff of the project, they can move it. So even when I understand your general point, but if we consider the complexity, the additional complexities of the principal agent relationship, I think that it's not so clear the final conclusion, at least in theoretical terms. You can build a scenario in which it's not the decision or it's not obvious the answer about the that really when you make you give more power to shareholders, you are going to increase the systemic risk.
I'll take two more. There's a gentleman up front who's obeyed all the rules, who's been raising his hand since the beginning. So someone should get a microphone to him. And if somebody else has the microphone, maybe the person can.
I have the microphone.
Please go ahead.
Yeah. I have a question also to Professor Coffey. My name is Yael Almog. I'm from the Israel Securities Authority. And I have a question about the issue of externalities and how it is affected by the ownership structure of the company. And you mentioned that we need to tailor our corporate governance regimes to our market realities. And indeed, in Israel, and I know in many other countries, the ownership structure of most of our companies is a concentrated ownership structure, whereas most of the banks that you mentioned that were weak throughout the crisis were dispersed ownership structure. And my question is whether the issue of externalities plays out differently in those two contexts, mainly mentioning that when you have a controlling shareholder of the bank, you do not have the factor of his dispersed or his portfolio diversifies. He does bear the entire risk, and when we tailor the corporate governance regime, whether this is not an important factor to take into account. Thank you.
Sorry, one last one.
Thank you. My name is Hugh Saville. I look after shareholder interests at the Association of British Insurers. I represent, therefore, the kind of environment that Dr. Armstrong described of committed long-term shareholders. I do not understand or recognize the view of shareholders put forward by Professor Coffey. I look on in despair at the moment as securities regulators blunder into the corporate governance world. There is a really limited amount of weight that corporate governance can bear, and I fear you're pushing too much weight onto it. It won't do the things that you want it to. You need to draw a clear distinction between corporate governance as regulating a company and corporate governance as sorting out the relationships between a company and its stakeholders. This is the balance that Cadbury was talking about. If you push too much towards the prescriptive end, you do damage to those relationships between the company and their stakeholders. If you do that, you will limit the flow of capital to the markets just at the time when we need it. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I know that there are many other questions. I think the great thing is that I can't see from where I am, so I couldn't see some of the others. But what we will do, I think all of us are here for the rest of the time. I think we'll have an opportunity to interact on a one-on-one basis and discuss these topics, which are extremely important topics. What I'd like the panelists to do, and I'll start with Dr. Armstrong, is every panelist makes the closing remarks, takes some of the issues that were directed at you specifically, and any other comments that you'd like to make as takeaway for us from what you've heard. From the comments and the questions that were raised. Dr. Armstrong.
I'll try and answer the one question that I was asked, and I think it somehow circles right around to the statement made by the last delegate. The problem I can't honestly say to you that there's been any, with probably one exception, and I hope I don't embarrass the participants who I know are here, but I felt it was a good example that at least we were not responsible for, but we had some involvement in, and that was the approach that Brazil took in developing the Novo Mercado, which I presume a number of you might be familiar with, and we won't have time now to discuss it, and they'll be probably a better place than me to talk about it. But there was a real public-private partnership, a sense of understanding the environment, what they needed to do in the environment to improve governance, attract investment, and the natural processes that flowed from that. But it wasn't an overnight success. I think it took some sort of, it took 3 to 5 years before it really got embedded and recognized, and now it's a sort of very much a benchmark that many people are looking at in terms of, without bringing in strong mandatory and obligatory enforcement around corporate governance principles, and I agree with the last intervention, which then tends to muddle up the whole issue about what are you trying to really regulate, and it gets all muddled up with how you really interfere with the way companies actually run themselves. But that would probably be the one example. The problem we've had, frankly speaking, is the points that were highlighted just now in that final intervention, which is that this whole issue of corporate governance is being relied upon far too much to remedy a lot of the market's ills. And I suppose that's surprising, possibly coming from someone like myself, but that the issue is about, Arthur did make the point earlier on about be careful what you wish for, because governance won't fix all of the issues. There's a whole range of other structural issues in the market. So a lot of our work has been really trying to get regulators in the markets we work in to understand there's a whole lot of other intersecting issues that they really need to understand, and what really drives and incentivizes that market and the behaviors that you want. And it's not going to be a corporate governance code alone and some of the complications that they try and introduce by making it a more mandatory or regulated process in the absence of other intersecting interests. And I think perhaps I should leave it at that.
Thank you. And I know, Dr. Van Zyl, in your introductory remarks, you made the same point. Exactly. About making sure that you have the other.
Exactly.
System.
I think, coming from a business, I mean, I'm not going to address the issues, but maybe there's some resonance with, what somebody called, because of what's been happening worldwide now, it's tsunami of regulation coming our way.
Sorry, tsunami of regulation.
Regulation. at a conference about a week or two ago. It's just, since this has come into play, I've just looked at our own business and the cost of the insurance providers from external auditors, internal auditors, compliance officers, the stuff, their budgets, as a percentage of our company's profit, and expressed that. If I look at the period 2000 to 2005, it worked around 3 to 3.5%. We're now at about 7.5%. Of our operational profit, that is. And we're just now embarking on a whole new regulatory regime on treat clients fairly on the one side, on the market conduct side, and on the prudential side, Solvency II, Basel III, and these kinds of things, which we think will take us to 10-12% of profit. And what happens is if you have these different circumstances that we're referring to in different places, it really becomes a serious way in which people conduct business. And if we don't have a similar way of treating it, we simply get in businesses, and particularly the multinationals, we get regulatory arbitrage. People move to where it's cheaper to do business, where they can make more money. And, I mean, sitting at a board, the one place you can make a 10% return and the other place a 15% return, easier, no compliance. What does the board decide? It goes to the one jurisdiction. So increasingly, these things will have to be in balance. We simply cannot just make more rules. We'll have to be able to enforce that. And the plea from business is, let's get more balance. Let's make the rules that we put in place enforceable, Let the people play with it. We don't want to reward people from playing outside the rules. So let's make the rules fairly simple, and let's make them relevant within their jurisdiction. And that's the plea.
Thank you. Professor Coffey.
Well, I hear I'm getting some pushback, and that is desirable. So make sure I clarify what I am saying. To begin with, I think the job of the manager and the corporate director is to maximize value for shareholders within the boundaries set by law and prevailing corporate ethics. No director should ever feel entitled to make a decision that because the costs of compliance are greater than the penalties set by law, we can break the law and pay the penalty. There has to be a recognition that there are mandatory limits set by law and set also by prevailing corporate ethics that are generally recognized in the community. I'm not trying to impose any new special ethical standards. Next point, banks are different. Banks represent a quasi-public utility because, again, the real residual risk faced by the bank is not borne by the shareholders. It's borne by the country where that bank is too big to fail. We have those in the United States, and I suspect that we will have those in emerging markets as well. Now, the point several of you were making, and I think Yael Allman made it quite incisively, is the structure of ownership does determine a number of things and the kind of risks you're exposed to. In basically, corporate governance shifts between two poles. On one pole, we have dispersed ownership systems, the US and the UK. Those are systems in which no shareholder, no individual shareholder or institutional shareholder owns more than 5% of the stock. So control is there in a fluid group of basically institutional shareholders. Then we have at the other pole concentrated ownership systems, which are still the prevailing mode, although there is growth among dispersed ownership systems. Now, in concentrated ownership systems, very different patterns are observed. First of all, in dispersed ownership systems, usually the villain in a scandal is the manager who's not controlled and is either taking excessive risk or is somehow receiving money under the table. In a concentrated ownership, the managers are very closely controlled by the controlling shareholder, and the potential villain in a scandal is more likely to be the controlling shareholder. You have to chercher la crook by looking at what the ownership structure is. Now, when we talk about executive compensation, it's much more of a problem in dispersed ownership systems because it's in the dispersed ownership systems that shareholders seeking to get managers to conform to the market's preferences use executive compensation, incentive stock compensation in particular, to align the manager's self-interest with the preferences of the market. There are problems in doing that, particularly in the case of financial institutions. I'm not saying incentive compensation is bad. I think it's quite good if your company is making widgets or software, but I think once we get into the world of financial institutions where the externality can be a liquidity shock that sets down the whole economy in a matter of days, and our whole economy was nearly shut down following the Lehman crisis in a matter of days, that's where we have to worry about externalities, and the key externality identified by any number of committee, I think they overstate as a matter of fact, is that somewhat warped systems of executive compensation created a moral hazard problem. All right, now, I'm hearing from those who are saying, we are shareholders that focus on the long term. There are lots of differences in shareholders, too. I think the diversified indexed institutional investor, particularly the indexed institutional investor, does not pressure for greater risk-taking or leverage. They tend to be fairly passive if they're indexed. On the other hand, we have in the US and the UK a world of hedge funds who tend to be the new instigators in proactive corporate governance, and they do push for different proposals, greater risk-taking, higher leverage, and they encourage the use of incentive compensation to get managers to agree with their preferences. So I agree with Yael's point. When you are dealing with a concentrated ownership system, there probably will be less use of incentive compensation. You don't need to use it. You can tell the manager what you want him to do. You can communicate directly. And there is probably, because you are less diversified as a controlling shareholder, less risk tolerance, you're more worried about the failure of that institution. The world is different, and my basic point is, which I said now several times, is the mandatory enabling balance in corporate law has to vary with the particular environment that you are in. But I think over the long run, we'll continue to see some drift in the direction of more dispersed ownership because institutional investors are a growing force, and we're going to see pension funds beginning to break up the ownership structure of all those traditional family-controlled firms. I think that covers most of the points. The last thing to say again, as we said yesterday, no good crisis should go to waste. You always have to focus on where the externalities are, where the misincentives exist, and regulators have to adapt. I think that you can't discuss systemic risk significantly without focusing on the problems of executive compensation.
Thank you. Judge King.
Thank you. Just dealing with Jeff von Rooyen. In every jurisdiction, and I've worked in several, sometimes with Philip, that the basic principles of good governance are fairness, accountability, responsibility, transparency. Those are the pillars. But it's based on a foundation of intellectual honesty. That honest application of mind in the best interests of this incapacitated entity, the company, that's so dependent on you and me as individuals. And without that independence of mind, you are not going to get a decision probably in the best interests of the company. Because then you're coming to the decision-making table with intellectual baggage and inclined towards perhaps those who nominated you, which is, of course, poor governance and in breach of your duty towards this incapacitated juristic person. The non-executive director has the same obligations in law and duty to the company as the executive director. There is no difference. Once you're appointed a director, you are pregnant. There are no half measures. You have the same duty of care, good faith, skill, diligence. It's a question of fact in each case that a court must determine your level of knowledge and your participation and your application of mind in that issue. Remembering that boards make collective decisions, but when something goes wrong, you've got individual liability and responsibility of the directors. Then the question of more power to shareholders. One of the international trends today is to put the question of remuneration to a non-binding vote of approval to the shareholders. That's going like wildfire around the world. And if the shareholders don't approve it, it's a clear signal to the board that they should relook at the policy of remuneration of their executives. The question is, where does this stop? When you're going to discharge your duty as a director to take risk for reward, so it's part of your duty to grow the company, the value of the company, you're not going to get it right 10 out of 10. None of us is prescient. We can't see into the future. If I took off my shirt now, I'd filled with corporate scars, the business judgment errors I've made. And I don't know any of you, but you've all done it. None of us can get it right 10 out of 10. Then what does it mean? We must put our business judgment decisions to the shareholders for their decision. Then the question is, do you need a board? It leads to a debate. Is the limited liability company the correct medium in which to conduct business? I think it is. But as soon as you push more and more to the shareholders, you're destroying that entity, which has proved to be the entity where you pool human and monetary capital more than any other entity that we know on our planet. So, on the question of concentration of ownership, again, one must remember the sovereignty of this juristic person, the company. If I said to any one of you today, I own you, I think you'd be horrified. Shareholders do not own companies. There are rights. If the board declares a dividend, the shareholder can get the dividend. But there's also this phrase used of the general body of the shareholders. What is that? I ask students sometimes, define it for me. How do you define it? You cannot define it. Is it some are shareholders, some are not? There are usually two classes of shareholders. Forget about preference shares and deferred shares and everything. They're share traders and share owners. Traders can selfishly decide to deal in their shares without caring what impact it might have on other shareholders or the company or any of the stakeholders. Share owner, who's got this long-term vision for their ultimate beneficiaries, particularly pension funds, must have a different approach. If a controlling shareholder tries to fetter the decision of a director, they are aiding and abetting a fraud on the incapacitated company. Because the duty of a director is to come to that decision-making table completely unfettered, with an open mind, listen to the input from his fellow directors, and make a decision in the best interests of the company with the purpose of the maximization of the total economic value. Notice not just the shareholder value, the total economic value. And then just the last point. I agree entirely with the last delegate that you need a light touch with these things. You cannot use corporate governance as a stick. It will not work. Remember, the most efficient compliance officer and regulator of the company is in fact its stakeholders. You adopt a process or a practice which is not acceptable to your stakeholders, they will flee your company. The share owner will sell its shares, the customer will not support you, a supplier might not even supply you. The stakeholder is the ultimate compliance officer. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to do what I usually do when I moderate panels, even though we've run far out of time, is attempt to give a very quick summary. I think it's one of the toughest jobs I've had because this is an issue that seems to be evolving. And each time I listen to any of the panelists, I learn something new. But I will attempt because I did try to pick up things that I thought were really profound. What is Judge King's definition of the world order? New capitalist, pension funds, a new civic economy, and I would suggest some new regulators like his young grandson. I also learned about the decade of stupidity, the 2000 to 2010 era. But I think what is profound is that today we've got about 7 billion people in the world. And as he highlighted, by 2035, the UN expects that we'll have 9 billion. Sorry, 2010. 2045, okay. The UN estimates that we will have about 9 billion people. And already there are no vacancies because of all the stupid things we've done. And so he then highlights the value of integrated reporting, of focusing on sustainability issues, but also focusing on it on an ongoing basis, so engaging all the stakeholders as part of developing a corporate strategy. And then highlight some of the other issues that also came up yesterday, the alternative dispute resolution mechanism, a much more risk-based approach to internal audits, some of what we're dealing with given the information technology issues, and then also encourages us in the current environment that we are in to try to use a 21st century approach rather than what is an outdated approach, a 20th century approach. We had discussions around, inspired by Professor John Coffey, around ensuring that we truly understand, and I would summarize it globally, ensuring that we truly understand the issues and when we make decisions and choices, that we're actually addressing what we would like. And I thought it was fully captured when he said that shareholders engage in systemic risk activities but do not bear the full cost, and that ultimately what happened with the global financial crisis was that you had the taxpayer ultimately bearing this. And so as we as regulators either promulgate codes or rules, we need to think about truly that we're addressing the right issues and ensuring that the mischief that we're trying to address or remedy is actually what we do. Dr. Van Zyl encouraged us to focus on implementation issues, but look at it in a much more holistic manner. That it's not just the code, that the context, the environment is extremely important. And we got a lot of advice from the wealth of experience of Dr. Armstrong on corporate governance. First, we shouldn't just take one from another jurisdiction, and that we should focus on what works for us. Develop a code that is fit for purpose, but also think about how you regulate. So keep it simple is extremely important. And also, like Dr. Van Zyl talked about, us taking account of our environment. He highlighted, of course, some of the approaches which Judge King had also mentioned about this whole issue of dialogue. And so a private-public sector dialogue allows us to better understand all of the stakeholders and understand our environment. And I thought one point, Dr. Armstrong, that you made, which for me was interesting, is also focusing on building capacity for other stakeholders. And so the media, training the media, so that, and then the use of scorecards and publicizing the results. And I'm glad that we did have a chance to acknowledge the experience of Brazil with the Novo Mercado. I think we in Nigeria have found it a great example of a good public-private partnership, and we're looking at ways in which we can apply that in our environment. And Professor Coffey also had talked about issues around externalities, and I like the point you made about let's not waste this unprecedented global financial crisis. And let's make sure that we truly learn from it. It's been an amazing panel for me, and I hope that you feel that way. What I ask of my panelists is to make themselves available for individual discussions, because I sense that there were quite a few other questions and comments. But I also will appreciate if IOSCO can make sure that your talking points are put on the website so that they're available, and that so we can continue to engage on this very important issue. Please join me in applauding this distinguished panel that I've had the honor to moderate. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. So this is, okay, so I need to.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Lunch is now served, and please do try to be back at 2 o'clock. Thank you so much to our panel and to Aruna, of course, for moderating that. Please do enjoy lunch, and we'll see you back at 2 o'clock.